memories at the other end, fragments of a voice that are getting weaker and weaker. Hogg comes into the room and tries to help Bobo with his tie, but it doesn't end up much better. It was always Aunt Katrine who knotted their ties, both her husband's and her son's, whenever the family had to go to a funeral. So Bobo ties it around his head like a headband instead, and his brother and sister burst out laughing. He wears it like that all the way to the funeral, just because it makes them laugh. The priest talks. No one in the family really hears what's being said, even though they're sitting at the front, as close to one another as they can get. Aunt Katrine always liked that, the fact that her family was a little flock that sought warmth from each other. She used to say, "A bigger house? Why would we want a bigger house? We're always in the same room anyway." People come up to Hogg afterward trying to sum her up. It's impossible. She was too many things. A talented nurse at the hospital, a much-loved colleague who was always willing to help, a loyal and cherished friend, the great love of one man's life, and the only mother three very different children will ever have. There's only one person being buried, but she was many more women than that for those left behind. All the people in the church wish they had asked her more questions. Death does that to us. It's as if Peter and Kira are living in parallel now, rather than together. After the funeral, they walk out of the church side by side, but there's a distance between them, just enough to prevent their hands accidentally brushing against each other. They get into separate cars, but neither of them puts the key into the ignition. They're both falling apart, at opposite ends of the parking lot. It's terrible being dependent on other people. The pair of them have always known that. One summer night a few years ago, they were sitting on the steps in front of the house. There'd been a news report of a road accident in which two young children had died, and it had brought their own grief back to them. You never stop losing a child. Kira whispered to Peter, "God, it was so painful, darling. When Isaac died, if I'd had to deal with that much pain alone, I'd have killed myself." Perhaps she and Peter have managed to stick together through everything because they didn't trust themselves to cope alone. So they were constantly on the hunt for other things to live for. Each other, the children, a job with a purpose, a hockey club, a town. Peter looks through the windshield and sees Kira sitting in her car. So he gets out and walks over to her, opens the passenger door, and says tentatively, "We should go back to their house, darling. To Hogg and the children." Kira nods slowly and wipes eyeliner from the small lines in the skin around her eyes. When Isaac died, Hogg and Peter's other childhood friend, Tails, traveled all the way to Canada as soon as they could. They knew Peter and Kira would be in shock, so Tails helped with the practical arrangements, papers and documents and insurance. To start with, Hogg mostly sat on the steps in front of the house, unsure of what to do. He'd never even been abroad before. But he noticed that the handrail of their living room stairs was broken, and handrails in Canada are much the same as they are in Beartown, so Hogg fetched some tools and mended it. Then he went on mending things for the next few days. "Your car or mine?" Peter whispers now. "Mine," Kira says, moving her purse from the passenger seat. She drives to Hogg and the children's house. Halfway there, she cautiously reaches across. Peter takes her hand and holds it tight. Fatima, Amit's mother, is already there. She's standing in the kitchen making food, and Kira helps her. Amit is there, too. He goes to get Bobo and his brother and sister, and says the only thing a teenage boy can think of to say to a friend who's just lost his mother. "Do you want to play hockey?" They fetch sticks and a puck. Bobo wraps his tie around his head again, holds the younger children's hands, and sets off toward the lake. It's frozen over. The world is white, and they play as if nothing else matters. Peter finds Hogg in the garage. He's already gone back to work. His hands need to be busy to stop his heart from breaking even further. "Is there anything I can do?" Peter asks. Hogg is sweaty and distracted when he replies, "The roof got damaged in the storm. Can you take a look at it?" Grief can do that to a person. He's forgotten that his friend is all thumbs and couldn't even mend his own handrail in Canada. But Peter loves Hog, the way children love their best friends. So he fetches a ladder and clambers up onto the roof. While he's sitting up there without the faintest idea of where to start, he sees a cavalcade of cars approaching through the forest. At first, Peter thinks it's Hog's family, but when the cars stop, a group of young men get out. Tima and Vidar are first, followed by Spider and Woody, then another dozen men in black jackets. They usually get their cars and snowmobiles fixed here, as do their parents. If a snowblower or piece of forestry machinery or even a kettle breaks around here, people bring them to Hog. So they're here now that he's broken. Tima walks into the garage, shakes the mechanic's oil-smeared hand, and says, "We're sorry for your loss, Hog. What do you need help with?" Hog wipes the sweat and dirt from his face. "What have you got?" "A carpenter, an electrician, a few guys who are just strong, and some who aren't much use at all," Tima says. Hog gives him a weak smile. Peter is still sitting on the roof when Woody and Spider climb up. They look at each other, and Peter takes a deep breath and admits, "I don't know anything about roofs. I don't even know where to start." Woody doesn't say anything. He just shows Peter what to do. Then the three of them spend several hours working together. When they finally climb back down, they may well be enemies again, but they've taken a breather up on the roof. Death can do that to us, too. Tima goes into the kitchen. He stops abruptly when he catches sight of Kira. Her jaw muscles tense and her fists clench so quickly that Fatima instinctively stands between them without knowing who's in greater danger. But Tima takes a step back, his shoulders sink, and he lowers his head, making himself as small as possible. "I just want to help," he says, "because sometimes it's easier to do something rather than say something." So Fatima and Kira glance at each other. Kira gives a curt nod, and Fatima asks, "Can you cook?" Tima nods. Fatima knows who his mother is. She realizes that the boy had to learn to prepare meals at an early age. She asks him to chop vegetables, and he does it without protest. Kira washes up afterward. Tima dries. They don't make peace, but they take a break. The complicated thing about good and bad people alike is that most of us can be both at the same time. It's so easy to place your hope in people, to think that the world can change overnight. We demonstrate after an attack, we donate money after a disaster, we lay our hearts bare online. But for every step forward we take an almost equally large step back. Seen over time, every change is so slow that it's barely visible when it's happening. The bell rings in Beartown School. Classes start. But Benji is standing 100 feet from the entrance with feet made of cement. He knows who he is in everyone's eyes now. One hockey game isn't going to change that. They may accept him on the ice as long as he's the best, but he's always going to have to give them much more than everyone else now. He will always have to be grateful just for being allowed to take part, because he isn't one of them, and never will be again. He knows people are still writing shit about him, saying shit, making jokes. It doesn't matter who he is, how good he is at a particular sport, how much he fights, how hard he plays. In their eyes, he will still only be one thing. A certain type of person will always take everything he ever achieves and boil it down to the same 3 letters. Like the note on the door of the cabin at the campsite, where the letter A was drawn like a target, flanked by the letter F and G, with a knife stuck through the middle. That's all he's allowed to be now. He turns around to walk off in the other direction. For the first time in his life, he's scared of school. But there's a young woman standing a short distance away, waiting. She doesn't touch him, but her voice still stops him in his tracks. "Don't let the bastard see you cry, Benji." Benji stops, his eyes wide open. "I can't bear it. How do you do it?" Maya's voice is weaker than her words. "You just go in. With your head held high and your back straight, and you look every single bastard in the eye until they look away. We're not the ones there's something wrong with, Benji." Benji hears himself crack as he asks, How did you bear it? Back in the spring, after everything, how did you cope? The look in her eyes is hard, her voice brittle. I refuse to be a victim. I'm a survivor. She walks toward the school. Benji hesitates for an eternity before following her. She waits for him, walks by his side. Their steps are slow. Perhaps it looks as though they're moving slowly, but they don't creep quietly into that corridor. They take it by storm. Chapter 43. We're Everywhere. The days blur together in Beartown this year. Perhaps we can't bear to keep track of either time or our feelings. At some point, the autumn comes to an end and winter arrives, but we barely notice. Time merely passes. Most of us are preoccupied just trying to get out of bed each morning. Kira keeps going to work, but it never really feels like it. She arrives later and later, leaves earlier and earlier, and she knows that her name won't be mentioned next time there's talk of promotion. She doesn't go to the conference she was invited to attend. She doesn't have the energy to think about the future. She's just trying to get through the day, fixed permanently in survival mode. As usual, it's her colleague who tells her a few home truths. One afternoon, Kira manages to go to the wrong room for a conference call and walks in on a planning meeting where her colleague is presenting a strategic plan to an important client. Kira stops in the doorway and looks at her colleague's notes on the board. They're brilliant, as always, but if Kira had been involved, they would have been even better. She waits outside after the meeting, and when her colleague comes out, Kira says, "That's my specialty, you know that. I could have helped you with the presentation. Why didn't you ask me to help?" Her colleague doesn't look angry. She's not trying to hurt Kira. She just replies honestly, "Because you've given up, Kira." Deep down inside, most of us would like all stories to be simple, because we want real life to be like that too. But communities are like ice, not water. They don't suddenly flow in new directions because you ask them to. They change inch by inch, like glaciers. Sometimes they don't move at all. No one confronts Benji at school. Who would dare? But every day his phone fills up with text messages from unidentifiable numbers, and every time he opens his locker, people have stuck notes in the gap around the door. All the usual words, the same old threats. He soon gets used to it. He becomes very good at pretending nothing's going on, and those who wish him ill take this to mean that he has it too easy, that he's not being punished hard enough, not suffering enough, so they need to think of something else. William Leet comes to school one day wearing a t-shirt with a target on the front. It's so small and discreet that only Benji notices it. The note that was pinned to the door of the cabin that morning when everyone had just found out the truth had the same target on it, drawn as the letter A in the word fag. Benji tore the note off at once and destroyed it. It never appeared anywhere online, so he knows that the person who left it there is the only person who knows what it looked like. William Leet wants him to know who it was. He wants Benji to remember the knife. Winning a game of hockey isn't enough. Benji looks him in the eye. They're standing a few feet apart in a corridor on an ordinary day in a long winter term, and all the other students are blithely milling past between classes on their way to the cafeteria. It's a moment that exists only for the two boys, one from a red team, one from a green, a bull and a bear. Sooner or later, one of them will end up crushing the other. The teams in the league play each other twice per season, one home game, one away game. Beartown Ice Hockey will win all its games up until then, and Hied Hockey will win all of its. The schedule is counting down inexorably to the return fixture, this time in Beartown's ice rink. All sports are fairy tales. That's why we lose ourselves in them. So, of course, there's only one way for this one to end. Maya is skipping school, but she has carefully picked a day when she has hardly any classes. Even when she breaks the rules, she does so responsibly. She gets onto the bus and travels for a long time to a town beyond reasonable commuting distance. Then she goes into a large brick building with a letter in her hand and at the reception asks for a lawyer. When she walks into her mom's office, her mom knocks her coffee over in surprise. "Darling, what are you doing here?" Maya hasn't been to Kira's office since she was little, but she used to love going there. Other children would get bored with their parents' workplaces, but Maya liked seeing her mom concentrating on something, seeing her passion. It taught the daughter that there are some adults who have jobs they really care about and aren't only doing for the money. That work can be a blessing. She looks worried when she puts the letter down on her mom's desk, worried about making her parent feel abandoned.
"It's from a music school. I applied. It was just... I just wanted to know if I was good enough. I sent them a video of me playing my own songs, and..."
The mother looks at her daughter's letter. Just seeing the letterhead is enough to make her start to sniff. Kira studied hard when she was growing up so that she would be accepted into a highly academic school. She dreamed of studying law even though no one in her family had ever been to university. She wanted rules and frameworks, security and a career ladder. She wanted the same thing for her children, a life where you know what to expect, free from disappointment. But daughters are never the same as their mothers, so Maya has fallen in love with the freest, least regulated subject she can think of. Music.
"You got in."
"Of course you got in," Kira sniffs, so proud that she can't even stand up. Maya sobs.
"I can start in January. I know it's a really long way away, and I'll have to borrow money. I understand if you don't want..."
Kira just stares at her.
"Don't want? Of course I... Darling, I've never been happier for you."
They embrace, and Maya says,
"I want to do this just for me, Mom. Something just for me. Do you understand?"
Kira understands. Better than anyone. The next day, she gets to the office earlier than everyone else. When her colleague arrives at work, she finds Kira sitting in her chair. Her colleague raises her eyebrows, and Kira lowers hers. "Don't you ever tell me I've given up again. All I ever do is not give up." Her colleague grins and whispers, "Shut up and send an invoice." The two of them hand in their notice that morning. Then in the afternoon, they sign a contract for the premises they've been dreaming about and set up their own company. People in Beartown have never been the sort to demonstrate on the streets. They don't go on marches. Their opinions are conveyed by other means. That can be hard for outsiders to understand, but very little happens by chance in this community. Even if something looks like a coincidence, it usually isn't. Beartown Ice Hockey plays a few home games at the start of the season with the standing area of the rink intact. And Peter can't help hoping, possibly naively, that his excuse that there's no one prepared to demolish it has been accepted. But the factory's new owner eventually sends an unambiguous email. "If the club doesn't take firm action to get rid of the hooligans known as the Pack, we will have no option but to cancel our sponsorship contract." So when the crowd arrives for one home game at the start of the winter, there are security guards standing in front of double layers of tape, cordoning off the standing area. Everyone has to make difficult choices this year. Peter chooses one path for the survival of the club. So the Pack chooses its response for its own survival. Peter is sitting at the back of the stands, waiting for them to start shouting at him. He's half expecting someone to rush up and punch him, but no one so much as looks in his direction. The rink is sold out, but there are no banners, no signs. Everyone behaves as if this were just a perfectly normal game. The things that happen when this town chooses a side are so small that you could miss them even if you were standing right in front of them. The majority of the hockey crowd here are ordinary, decent people who would never condone violence. A lot of them moan about the Pack in the privacy of their own homes, about how thugs are giving the club a bad name and scaring off players and investors alike. But choosing sides in a conflict is rarely about who you're standing alongside and almost always about who you're standing against. This community may have its own internal arguments, but it always stands united against outsiders. If a rich company wants to buy the factory and gain power over our jobs, we can't stop it. But if they think they can buy our club and control our way of life, they've picked the wrong town to fight with. The pack may symbolize violence to a lot of people, but to the neighbors who received help clearing fallen trees in their yards and were then offered a pint in the bearskin afterward, they symbolize other things too. To them, the pack is a small group of people who refuse to take any crap, who don't change to suit the demands of power and money and politics. They have their shortcomings, they make mistakes, but it's hard for anyone in Beartown not to sympathize with them, especially in times like these. It isn't completely right, but it isn't completely wrong either. It just is. It takes Peter a long time to notice the black jackets. They're sitting spread out around the hall in different parts of the seated area. Obviously, he had been expecting that, but there are considerably more of them than ever before. Several hundred. Only when Peter looks at them carefully does he realize why. It isn't just the pack. There are pensioners, factory workers, cashiers from the supermarket, employees of the housing association. It's not a march, it's not a noisy demonstration, and if Peter had asked, they would have pretended not to understand. What do you mean? No, it's just a coincidence. Peter doesn't have any proof, of course, because the jackets are different makes, different fabrics. But they're all the same color. And there are very few coincidences in Beartown. No one was surprised when he cordoned off the stand today, because someone saw to it that the news reached the right people in advance. He knows who. The only people Peter was obliged to tell in advance were the club's board members. He needed their approval to bring in extra security. Peter made his choice, and Ramona responded. He gave her a place on the board, so she would make decisions she believes to be in the best interests of the club. Now he has to take the consequences. In the intermission between the first and second periods, a young man stands up among the seats on the far side. He's well-dressed, neatly turned out, doesn't look like a violent person. If anyone nearby had been asked, naturally they would have replied, "Him? No, I don't know him. What did you say his name was? Tima Renius? Never heard of him." He walks calmly and collectedly down to the front of the stand, walks along behind the boards, then turns up toward the cordoned-off standing area. There are two security guards there, but they make no attempt to stop him. Tima climbs through the cordon and walks casually across the stand, even stopping in the middle of it to tie his shoelace. He glances across the ice, seeking out Peter Anderson in the sea of people. Then he crosses the standing area, walks down the other side, and goes off to buy coffee, as if nothing has happened, even though everyone knows. Tima has just told Peter that this is his stand, and he can reclaim it whenever he likes. A few minutes later, the chanting begins. At first only in the seated area on the far side of the rink, then, as if on command, some men a few rows below Peter start to shout as well. Then it comes from the right and left of him, too. No one looks Peter in the eye, but the men in black jackets are chanting just for him. "We're everywhere! We're everywhere! We're everywhere! Come and have a go if you think you're hard enough, because we're everywhere, 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 we're everywhere." They chant it 10 times. Then they stand up and switch to, "We'll stand tall if you stand tall." Then they stand completely silent, disciplined, and focused to show how quiet the rink is then, and how much everyone would miss the pack's support if it disappeared. Then, as if at an inaudible signal, they start to chant again, and this time the whole rink joins in. Old and young, black jackets, white shirts, green t-shirts. "We are the Bears! We are the Bears! We are the Bears! The Bears from Beartown!" Beartown Ice Hockey win the game 7-1. The chanting from the stands is deafening. The crowd forms a green wall on both sides of the ice. There's a roaring sense of unity in the hall at that moment,
Us against everyone. Beartown against the rest. Peter has never felt more lonely. The following morning, there's an interview in the newspaper with a local politician, Richard Tew. The reporter asks him what he thinks about Beartown Ice Hockey's decision to get rid of the standing area, and Tew replies, "Beartown Ice Hockey is the people's club. It doesn't belong to an elite, to the establishment. It belongs to the ordinary, decent, hard-working people of this town. I'm going to do all I can to persuade the general manager that the standing area ought to be kept. Our supporters make a huge contribution to the atmosphere at games. It's the people's club." A couple of hours later, Peter receives another email from the factory's owners. They've changed their minds. Suddenly, they have been persuaded of the great value of the standing area to the local community. That's how Peter finds out that he was being deceived all along, the whole time. That evening, he sits alone in his kitchen at home, waiting for the sound of a key in the lock. It never comes. Kira stays at work late into the night. By the time she gets home, he's fallen asleep on the sofa. She covers him with a blanket. On the table stand a bottle of wine and two glasses. Chapter 44. Storm and Longing. It's far too late in the evening for there to be any lights on in the rink, but Elizabeth Zackel is still firing pucks when Bobo arrives. He didn't know she'd be there when he set off from home, but he was hoping. He read Harry Potter and got his brother and sister off to sleep. He did the washing and cleaning. Then he packed his things and came down here. It was instinctive. He can't sleep. His brain won't stop thinking. And he knows only one place where everything falls silent. "Can you teach me to skate?" he calls to Zackel. She turns toward him. She's never seen a young man in greater need of an escape from reality. "What do you mean?" she asks. "The first time we met, you asked why no one had ever taught me to skate." It's more of a plea than a statement. Zackel leans thoughtfully on her stick. "Why do you like hockey?" Bobo chews his bottom lip.
"Because it's fun?"
"That's not a good enough answer," she says. He breathes heavily, tries again.
I know who I am when I'm playing hockey. I know what's expected of me. Everything else is just so hard. But hockey is, it's just, I know who I am here."
Zackel taps her stick on the ice, evidently not entirely dissatisfied. "Okay. I suppose I'd better teach you to skate then." Bobo steps onto the ice and skates toward her, then stops and asks,
"Why do you like hockey?"
She shrugs. "My dad liked hockey. I liked my dad." Bobo frowns.
"So why did he like hockey?"
"He used to say hockey is a symphony orchestra. He liked classical music. Sturm und Drang."
"Is that a band?"
Bobo asks, and Zackel laughs out loud for once.
"It means storm and longing. My dad used to play me the same pieces of music over and over again, and he would say, 'It's every emotion, all at the same time, Elizabeth. Can you hear? Sturm und Drang.'
He felt the same about hockey. Sturm und Drang. The whole time." Bobo considers this for a while. Then he asks,
"So why do you stand here at night firing pucks?"
She smiles. "Because it's fun." Then she teaches him how to skate. After a few hours, Bobo asks if she thinks he could be a properly good hockey player one day. She shakes her head and replies, "No, but you could be a decent coach, if you can figure out how to be useful to the team." Bobo lies awake for the rest of the night thinking about this. At practice the next day, he walks straight out of the locker room, skates across the ice as fast as he can, and body checks Benjamin Ovich as hard as he can. Confused, Benji gets up and stares at him.
"What the?"
Bobo doesn't answer,
He just hits Benji's legs with his stick. The rest of the team just look on in amazement, unable to figure out how to react. Bobo's lost his mom, that might make anyone a bit crazy, but they all know Benji won't tolerate being hit again. "Bobo, stop it," Amit says gently, but Bobo hits Benji again. No one has time to stop Benji. Bobo is one of the heaviest players in the team, but Benji sends him flying into the boards, throws his gloves down, and flies at him with his fists clenched.
"What do you think everyone else is going to do?" Bobo yells.
Benji stops in surprise.
"What? What do you think everyone else is going to do? Every team we meet is going to try to provoke you. They want you to fight. They want you to take a penalty."
Benji stares at Bobo, along with the rest of the team. Amit mumbles, "He's got a point, Benji. People are going to shout worse and worse things until they find something that works. You mustn't react. Not you, and not Vidar. You're both too important to the team." Benji is breathing furiously through his nose, but in the end he calms down and helps Bobo up.
"Okay. Keep trying, then."
At every practice from then on, Bobo tries to find more and more creative ways to provoke both Benji and Vidar. Sometimes he succeeds and comes home with black eyes, even though they both know that's precisely what he's trying to make them do. It turns out that this is Bobo's unique talent in life, teasing people beyond their endurance. When Benji opens his locker one morning, there are notes at the bottom, as usual, but one of them is different. Just one word. "Thanks." The next day, there's another one, in different handwriting, saying, "I told my sister I'm bisexual yesterday." A few days later, there's a third note, again in different handwriting, which says, "I haven't told anyone else, but when I do, I'm not going to say I'm gay. I'm going to say I'm like you." Then someone sends him an anonymous text. "Everyone's talking about you. They see you as a symbol. I hope you know how important you are to all of us who daren't say anything." Just a few small notes and messages. Just words. Just anonymous voices who want him to know what he means now. Benji throws them into the same garbage can as all the other notes, because he doesn't know which feels worse, the threats or the love, the loathing or the expectations, the hate or the responsibility. He receives another sort of text message, too. They always start the same way. "Hi, don't know if I've got the right number. Are you the homosexual hockey player? I'm a journalist. I'd like to interview." One morning, Benji and his sisters go down to the lake, drill a hole in the ice, and drop his phone through it. Then they drill some holes farther away and fish and drink beer and keep quiet for the rest of the day. When Beartown Ice Hockey plays its next game on the road, the rumors about Benji have reached that town too. In every town he plays in from now on, there will be people who shout the most disgusting things they can think of to get him off balance. But Benji doesn't give in. He just scores goals instead. The more they yell, the better he gets. After the game, Bobo hugs him and exclaims happily, "If they hate you, you're doing something right. You're the best. They'd never hate you this much if you weren't best." Benji tries to smile, pretend it's nothing. But he can't quite stop himself from wondering how long he's going to have to be the best. How long it's going to take before anyone just lets him play. Anna and Vidar are the sort of love story in which neither of them really knows how to behave. So they end up just going for walks every day in the forest. The snow gets deeper in tandem with their infatuation. One afternoon, he touches her and she starts to cry hysterically. When he doesn't understand why, she tells him about Benji, how everyone found out about it, about the photograph, and Maya's furious reaction. "I don't deserve you. I'm a horrible person. I must be a psychopath," she cries. Vidar stands in front of her, and he might as well be naked when he replies, "Me too." How could anyone help falling even more in love with him then? Perhaps someone knows. Anna isn't one of them. The next morning when they get to school, Anna waits until she catches sight of Benji. When he opens his locker, small paper notes fall out, and Anna realizes what's written on them. She knows how much of other people's hatred Benji is having to carry within him now.
I have to, she whispers to Vidar.
Vidar tries to stop her, but it's impossible. She's suddenly set off along the corridor. Benji looks up in surprise and tries to hide the notes.
I know you hate me, but...
Anna begins, but doesn't manage to say more before the tears start to fall and her voice breaks.
Why would I hate you? Benji wonders.
And only then does Anna realize that Maya hasn't told anyone, not even him.
It was me. It was... took the picture of you, and it was me. Everything you're going through is my fault. It was me.
Her face contracts into wrinkles of shame that will never quite smooth out. Her whole body is shaking. Then she runs off, out of the school, away, away, away. Benji stands there for a moment, and his eyes meet Vidar's. The goalie does something he never does. He hesitates. She, Vidar begins, but Benji cuts him off. It's okay. Go after her. So Vidar does. He runs after her, doesn't catch up with her until they're half a mile away. She's so fast and strong that he doesn't stand a chance of getting her to slow down. So he runs alongside her, straight out into the forest until neither of them can breathe or think anymore. Then they collapse into the snow and just lie there. Vidar doesn't say a word. It's the finest thing anyone has ever done for Anna. Maya is sitting alone in the cafeteria, as she does every day. But out of the blue, someone sits down opposite her, as if he's been invited. She looks up. Benji points at her plate. Are you going to finish that, or can I have it? Maya smiles.
I shouldn't sit with you. You've got a bad reputation.
Benji looks impressed.
Ouch.
She laughs.
Sorry.
Sometimes you have to laugh at the crap. That's how you make it bearable. Benji grins. Then he says,
You should forgive Anna.
What?
She told me she posted the pictures of me and...
He's invincibly strong and unbelievably fragile at one and the same time. He reminds Maya a lot of Anna sometimes.
Why should I forgive her? What she did to you was horrible,
she snaps. But you're like sisters. And sisters forgive each other, Benji manages to say. Because he's got sisters. Maya tilts her head and asks,
Have you forgiven Anna?
Yes.
Why?
Because people make mistakes, Maya.
Maya eats her lunch without saying anything else. But after school, she walks through Beartown, knocks on a door, and when Anna opens it, says at once,
Get your running gear on.
Anna doesn't ask why. That saves their friendship. Chapter 45 Cherry Tree Whenever we get someone really good at sports in such a small town, this far into the forest, people in Beartown usually say it's like seeing a flowering cherry tree in the middle of a frozen garden. Peter Anderson was our first, so when he made it all the way to the NHL, it didn't matter to us that he played only a handful of games before his career was cut short by injury. He was there. One of us had made it to the best in the world. Peter transformed the whole town. He condemned us to a lifetime of never-ending, impossible dreams. Zacharias is 16 years old. People like him are easily forgotten in stories like this one. Most people know him only as Amit's friend. They know who Amit is because he's good at hockey, and hockey is the only thing that counts here. Zacharias's life is the sort that just carries on in the background. He and Amit grew up with Leifa. And there may never have been three such different boys around here who ended up being best friends anyway. Zacharias's parents never liked Leifa, especially when he started to be seen with the bandits, as Zacharias's parents called anyone in the Hollow who didn't seem to have a job to go to. But Amit, dear Lord, Zacharias's parents worshipped him. When he started playing on the A-team, they were as proud as if he'd been their own son. As if they wished he were. And things like that are impossible for a boy like Zacharias not to notice. Zacharias played hockey right up until this spring, even though he was the worst player on every team and didn't even enjoy it much. He went to practices for his parents' sake, put up with it for Amit's sake. When he heard there wasn't going to be a junior team this year, he felt relieved because it gave him an excuse to stop. He really only wanted to sit at home in front of his computer anyway. So when his mom and dad came home one day, all excited about an open tryout at Beartown Ice Hockey, he was overwhelmed with anxiety. "You have to go!" Zacharias has never been able to explain to his parents how badly bullied he has been throughout his childhood. For everything. His weight, his appearance, his address. They've never seen him that way. They're from the same generation as Peter Anderson, the generation of impossible dreams. Zacharias mumbled, "It doesn't work like that, Mom. You can't just show up." But his dad interrupted, "It's an open session. Anyone can turn up. And the factory is sponsoring Beartown Ice Hockey now. Just tell the coach that..." "That what, Dad?" "That she should let me play because my dad works at the factory?" Zacharias snapped and regretted it at once. Beartown Ice Hockey was set up by factory workers, and the older workers still think of it as the factory's club. Now that the factory's new owners are promising more jobs for people who don't have one, and more work for those who have, as well as sponsoring the club, Zacharias' dad has started to hope that everything is going to be like it used to be again. An affluent town, a club in the top division, permanent jobs, maybe even a chance for the family to move out of the apartment in the Hollow and buy a little row house. Nothing big, nothing flashy, just one more room and a slightly bigger kitchen. Heating that's more reliable in the winter. "Sorry, Dad, I didn't mean..." Zacharias said quietly. His dad's eyes were still glinting with happiness. It would mean a huge amount for both parents to see Zacharias play with the bear on his chest again. So Zacharias attended the open tryout. Of course he did. He gave it all he had. It was nowhere near enough. Afterward, he didn't even get a pat on the shoulder from the coach. She just said, "Sorry, we've got everyone we need, but thanks for coming," without so much as a second glance. When he got home, his parents looked as though they were fighting to hold back tears. Many years from now, he'll look back on that and realize what a sign of devotion that was. They were so incapable of seeing how bad he was at hockey that they were genuinely disappointed. That evening, his mom had another go at him about playing computer games. He tried to explain how good he'd gotten playing online, that he can hold his own against the best in the world, that he's even been invited to take part in a competition in another town. "A competition? In that? That's a computer game, Zacharias. That's not a sport," his mom snorted. Zacharias sat up playing all night, but her words tore at his chest. Alicia isn't even 5 years old yet, and children of that age shouldn't be as good at escaping from preschool as she is. "We can't be held responsible for that. This isn't a prison," the staff protested when Suna took her back for something like the 20th time. "It feels like it to her," Suna replied. Alicia was devoted to him because he understood. He kept trudging back from the rink to the preschool with her each day, and she kept running away again to go and watch the practices. Any practice. The A-team, Little League, figure skating, it didn't matter. As soon as the ice was empty for as much as a minute, she pulled her skates on and started to play. How do you stop that? On one of the days when Suna dragged her back to preschool, the staff took pity on him and invited him in for coffee. In the end, everyone accepted that it was easier if Suna just picked Alicia up from preschool in the morning, took her to the rink, and brought her back to preschool in the afternoon in time to have coffee there. One day in early winter, the staff mentioned that the preschool was riddled with mold, that they'd complained repeatedly to the council but had been told there were no suitable alternative premises. Suna looked at Alicia, thought the matter through carefully, Then he walked back to the rink, went up to Peter Anderson's office and asked him, "Do you really need this office?" "Sorry?" Peter said. Suna gestured toward the rest of the upper floor of the rink. "Almost all these offices are empty. There's only you, me, and Zakel here. Who else? A couple of office temps? The janitor?"
"There isn't anyone else. We're the club," Peter said.
Suna grabbed pen and paper and started to draw. "We knock out these walls, put in proper ventilation. It's perfectly feasible."
"Sorry, but what are you talking about?" Peter asked.
"More than a club. We can build more than a club," Suna thundered. The next day, he went to the politicians with his plan to build a preschool inside the ice rink. Most of them are dubious, some are openly scornful, but one of them sees the potential at once. When the other counselors say no, this one politician goes to a parents' meeting at the preschool and mobilizes an email campaign. Eventually, that convinces the other politicians to restructure the budget. Suna is given money to build the first ice rink preschool in the country. The children spend as much time playing on skates as they do in shoes that winter. A few years from now, Alicia will say it was those extra hours of practice that made her so fast and technically proficient. She will have forgotten that the politician who attended the parents' meeting was named Richard Tiu. But at the next election, there will be plenty of parents with young children who remember him. "It's only sports." That's what we try to tell ourselves. Amit calls Zacharias late one evening.
"What are you doing?"
Amit asks.
"Gaming," Zacharias replies.
Amit used to make fun of him for using that word, gaming, instead of playing games, as if Zacharias were trying to make it sound like a sport.
"Do you feel like coming out for a while?" he asks.
"Out? Now? It's as cold as a polar bear's asshole." Amit laughs. "I bet polar bear's assholes aren't cold at all. Just come out."
"What for?"
Amit swallows.
"Because I'm so nervous about the game against Hied that I can't sleep. Just come out."
So Zacharias goes out. Of course he does. They walk around the hollow, freezing and talking, the way they used to when they were younger and had nowhere else to go.
"How's the gaming going?" Amit asks.
"Just don't, okay?" Zacharias says, hurt.
"No, seriously. Tell me. Look, I just need to talk about something apart from hockey."
Zacharias sulks for a while, but eventually he says,
"It's going well. Really well, actually. I've been invited to take part in a competition."
"Can I come and watch?" Amit asks immediately. Zacharias can't possibly describe how proud he is to be asked, so he just grunts,
"Sure."
Then he adds crossly, "But not if you're going to say the same shit as my parents, that it's not a real sport simply because it isn't hockey."
Amit mutters guiltily, "Is that what your parents say?"
Zacharias kicks at the snow.
"They dream of having a son like you, Amit. Hockey's the only thing that counts in this town."
Amit doesn't say anything. There's nothing he can say. Maya arrives at the barn up at the kennels. Jeanette is already training inside with the sandbag, but Anna stops warily in the doorway.
"Is it okay if she joins in?" Maya asks.
Jeanette lets out a breathless, surprised laugh. "Of course! If there are three of us, we'll soon be a real club." She isn't prepared for what happens next. None of them are, not even Anna herself. But when Jeanette shows her a hold that she and Maya have been practicing, and Maya tries to remember exactly how to contort her limbs in order to get out of the hold but fails, Anna asks,
"Can I try?"
Jeanette hesitates. "This is, well, pretty advanced. Maybe we should start with something lighter."
"Can't I just try?" Anna asks.
So Jeanette lets her try, because sometimes you have to let some people fail in order for them to learn. The only problem with that theory is that Anna doesn't fail. Jeanette shows her the movement, and Anna duplicates it on her first attempt. Jeanette shows her a more difficult move, then another, even harder, and Anna manages them all by her second or third attempt. Jeanette is panting with her hands on her knees after 20 minutes, but Anna doesn't seem out of breath at all. Jeanette's old coach used to talk about physical intelligence and how some martial arts practitioners seem to have an equivalent of a musician's perfect pitch. When they see something, their body knows instinctively how to do the same thing. Anna played hockey for a few years when she was younger, but she's never done any martial arts. Even so, her physique seems perfectly suited to it. She's grown up in the forest, running on uneven ground, jumping and climbing. Her dad's a hunter and fisherman. She's tracked and shot and dragged heavy animals with him since she was a child. She shoveled snow and dug ditches and drilled holes in the ice on the lake. She's strong, supple, resilient, and tougher than one of the bearskin's pork chops. Jeanette holds her hands up and says, "Hit me as hard as you can." "Seriously?" Anna asks. Jeanette nods. "As hard as you can." Maya is sitting on the floor, and she'll never forget seeing this happen. Anna hits so quickly and so hard that Jeanette staggers backward. Anna just explodes. Jeanette and Maya start laughing. Anna doesn't even realize what's so special about what she's just done, but Jeanette is already planning her career. The three women inside the barn are wet with sweat. The landscape outside is deep frozen, covered in snow, sunk in darkness. But the whole town smells of cherry blossom. Early one morning, Zacharias's parents' doorbell rings. Ahmed is standing outside. Zacharias's mother looks both happy and frustrated. First, the happiness. "Ahmed, how lovely to see you! Congratulations on getting onto the A-team. We're so proud of you. Just think, we've had you running about here for so many years. You can't imagine how much we boast about you to the neighbors. Your mom must be so proud of you." Before Ahmed has time to reply, she moves straight on to the frustration. "I'm afraid Zacharias isn't home. He's gone to play computer games with some friends, several hours away. Can you imagine? What on earth's the point of that?" Ahmed takes a deep breath, because he's very fond of Zacharias's parents. But he says firmly, "Zach isn't playing games with some friends. It's a huge competition. He qualified ahead of thousands of other players. You should come and watch him with me." Zacharias's dad is standing further back in the hall. He doesn't want to insult Ahmed, but can't help snorting, "It's good of you to stand up for him, Ahmed, but playing computer games isn't a real sport." Ahmed fixes his eyes on him. "All through our childhood, Zach and I have competed to see who could turn professional first. He's going to win. If you aren't there to see it happen, you'll regret it for the rest of your lives." He turns and walks down the stairs before they have time to answer. When Zacharias walks into the vast hall where the competition is taking place, several hours away from Beartown, Ahmet is there to watch. Not a big army, but an army nonetheless. The floor where the computers are lined up is surrounded by tall banks of seating, full of spectators. There are screens hanging from the roof and music thundering from the loudspeakers. "It's almost like hockey," Zacharias's father concedes in amazement. He and Zacharias's mother caught up with Ahmed at the railway station. They drove here together instead. The parents walked in reluctantly, not really understanding any of it. But before the competition is over, the people around them will be cheering and applauding what Zacharias has done. When he wins, Ahmed will yell out loud and his parents will follow his example. A stranger in the row in front will turn around and ask Zacharias's mom, "Do you know him?" "He's my son," Zacharias's mom will exclaim. The stranger will nod and look impressed and will say, "You must be incredibly proud of him." It's not that important. It's only a sport. A different sport. Kira Anderson's own mother once said to her, "The hardest thing about having a family is that you're never finished." Kira can't quite forget that as she and her colleague furnish their office, chase clients and try to recruit staff, negotiate with the bank, and worry about money. Kira's phone keeps ringing the whole time. She looks at the photograph of the children on her desk with the same silent questions as always. For whose sake do you have a career? Is it worth all the sacrifices? How are you supposed to know that in advance? Peter Anderson comes home to an empty house. Kira is at work. The children are out with friends. Peter makes a meal for himself and eats it watching a hockey game on TV. His phone is silent. When he accepted the job of general manager all those years ago, he used to hate the sound of it ringing because it never stopped, not even when he was on vacation. Now he misses it. Maya Anderson puts the key into the lock and walks into the hall. Her dad gets up from the couch and tries to hide how happy he is not to have to be home alone. Maya is exhausted after her martial arts training, but when she sees the look on her dad's face, she goes to get her guitar. They play three songs together in the garage. Then the daughter asks, "Has Mom told you about music school?" Peter looks surprised, then embarrassed. Your mom and I, we haven't had much time to talk lately. Maya fetches the letter.
I can start in January. It's a long way away. I'd have to move and I need to borrow money, but Mom said it was okay.
Peter doesn't succeed in his attempt not to fall apart.
I just want you to be happy, Pumpkin. Just happy, he manages to say.
You know what, Dad? That's all I want for you, too, his daughter whispers.
Leo Anderson is walking alone through Beartown. He isn't going anywhere particular, has no plan, he's just walking about. When he's grown up, he'll remember this as the winter when he was desperate for something to feel passionate about. Everyone else seems to have something they love unconditionally. His dad has his club, his mom her new business, and Maya her music. Leo wants something of his own. Perhaps he'll find it. Perhaps that's another story. But this evening, when he comes home, his mom is still at work and his big sister has gone to bed. His dad is sitting in the living room watching television. Leo hangs his coat up, considers going straight to his room, like anyone else who's only just become a teenager. But this evening, he goes into the living room instead. He sits down next to his dad. They watch a hockey game together.
I hope you know how much I love you, his dad says during one of the breaks.
I know, Dad. I know.
Leo grins and yawns as if he takes that for granted. Peter can't help hoping that he might have done something right as a parent after all. They're both asleep on the sofa when Kira comes home. She covers the pair of them with blankets. You're never finished with a family. Chapter 46. We'll say it was a road accident. Have you ever seen a town fall? Ours did. Because sometimes it's so easy to make people hate one another that it feels incomprehensible that we ever do anything else. This has been a story about ice rinks and all the hearts that beat in and around them, about people and sports and how they sometimes take it in turns to carry each other, about us, dreaming and fighting. Some have fallen in love and some have been destroyed. We've had good days and some very bad ones. Beartown has cheered, but it has also started to smolder. Things were heading toward a terrible explosion. A few girls made us proud. A few boys made us great. A car drove too fast through the night. We'll say it was a road accident, but accidents are quirks of fate, and we will know that we could have prevented this one. This one will be someone's fault. Many people's fault. Our fault. Hockey is hockey. A game. Make-believe. When winter comes to Beartown and Hied, it's dark when you set out for work and dark when you come home. The staff in the emergency room of the hospital in Hied pass the time the way everyone else does. They talk hockey. Everyone is looking forward to the next game. Some support the red team, some the green team. There are doctors and nurses who can barely talk to each other. As the season has progressed and both teams have won all their other games, the next encounter between Beartown Ice Hockey and Head Hockey has become more and more important. The club that wins